every new administration which comes in says that it's going to do better than the previous one on terrorism, but terrorism continues. So although none of us are specialists in this area, when our good friend Gary Westmoreland, whom we bother much more than we ought to in the Alderman Library, where he is the authority on bibliography and many other things, told us about Ernest Evans, why we immediately seized on the opportunity to have him speak. He will speak on the presidency and the management of hostage crises, Iran and other cases. And I have a long obituary and a short obituary. I asked him which one I should use, and he said maybe a little of each. The essential point is that he's a member of the political science faculty at American University and taught at Catholic University and at Georgetown and Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. He received his bachelor's degree with Gary at Brown University, and that isn't where he was valedictorian, although he was magna cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa. But at Sidwell Friends High School in Washington, he was valedictorian. And I said, I wouldn't ask all of you in the room to raise your hand to let us know whether you could match him. He received his PhD from Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1977. He also was for 2 years head of the Washington Office of International Analysis Center, Inc., an independent consulting body for various research centers and government agencies and media. His books are, first, Calling a Truce to Terror, The American Response to International Terrorism, and Wars Without Splendor, The U.S. Military and Low-Level Conflict. He's written over 20 articles in scholarly journals and has lectured widely on his subject. We're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you. Well, first of all, it's a great honor to be here at this very distinguished research center, and what I will try to do is keep my remarks to about 30 minutes, because I know terrorism being very much in the news, thanks to the Ayatollah and various other parties, a lot of you will have questions, and I'll try to answer those questions as best I can. I find one of the best parts of these speaking arrangements is I get to talk to other people who are very knowledgeable, such as the members of the Miller Center here at the UVA. Well, let me give a quick overview of my talk. First, I want to say a little bit about the rationales for taking hostages, which is actually somewhat more complicated than it may seem on the surfaces, but why do terrorists take hostages? Secondly, I'd like to discuss a bit about how governments in general have responded to the problem of hostage taking. Thirdly, say a bit about the American presidency and problems involved in hostage crises, and conclude by saying possible solutions to some of the problems that we've had in managing hostage crises. Well, looking first at the rationale for taking hostages, there are essentially five key rationales for why terrorists take hostages. First, and one that's very current, is aggravating state-to-state relations so as to prevent an outcome the terrorists don't like. Now, the most recent example of this, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the blowing up of Pan Am flight last December was by radical forces within the Palestinian movement who were trying to derail Israeli-Palestinian cooperation. And if you look at the history of Israeli-Palestinian relations for the past 40, 50 years, you'll find that whenever there has been any movement towards accommodation between the Palestinians and the Israelis, or should I say between the more moderate Palestinians and the Israelis, the response by the radical wing of the Palestinian movement has been an act of terror. For example, in 1970, in response to the Rogers Peace Initiative, There was the famous hijacking to Dawson Field. Several airliners were hijacked to Dawson Airfield in Jordan, later blown up. 1978, in response to Sadat's visit to Jerusalem, there was the attack on a bus on the road from Haifa to Tel Aviv. A number of people were killed. Clearly, from the point of view of the radical Palestinians, every time there's any movement towards peace, they respond by a terrible act of terrorism designed to inflame passions and derail negotiations. So that's one reason why people will take hostages, is to stir up the waters a little bit and derail something they don't like. Secondly, and one familiar to all of us, is publicity. Publicity is a key weapon in the terrorist arsenal. I remember a case back in 1969, the U.S. ambassador to Brazil, Ambassador Elbrick, who was kidnapped by a Brazilian terrorist group, and he asked the terrorists, "Why did you take me?" And they said, "Well, nobody would have cared if we'd taken the Turkish ambassador." And there, clearly the answer is for terrorist publicity. Another example wasn't a hostage situation, but it illustrates terrorists' need for publicity. After the assassination in 1979 of Lord Mountbatten, a journalist in New Zealand called the Sinn Féin office in Dublin and said to the IRA official, "Why did you kill that harmless old man?" And the IRA official shot back, "Why are you calling me all the way from New Zealand?" And here again, the element of publicity is very clearly marked in terrorist incidents. Thirdly, there's the coercive element. Terrorists often will hold a hostage so as to put pressure on a government, to humiliate, to show it as powerless and weak. And perhaps the masters of this sort of hostage taking were the Tupamaros in Uruguay with their so-called people's prisons, where they would hold people. For example, British Ambassador Sir Geoffrey Jackson was held for 8 months in a people's prison. And while he was in this people's prison, the government frantically searched for him but couldn't find him. And of course, it was a terrible humiliation for the government. Government credibility and public support declined because they were seen as helpless in the face of the Tupamaro guerrillas. The Tupamaros said, "We are operating a parallel state. We have our own prisons, our own army, our own caches of arms. You can't do anything about it." So that's a third point, coercion and intimidation of government. Fourthly, terrorists hope to cause polarization of society. And to understand this theory a bit, you have to remember one theory of terrorist movements is that the way to bring down a government is to force governmental repression, force a government to act in an unconstitutional way, and thereby force a polarization of society which the terrorists are convinced will eventually benefit them. So, for example, in 1970, some terrorists in Guatemala kidnapped and later killed the German ambassador in the hope that this would lead to a government crackdown, which would enable them to say, "See, the democratic facade in Guatemala is just what we've always said it is. It's not real. It's a phony democratic state." And this will lead to government repression and hopefully polarization. Well, the final purpose of terrorist hostage situation is the one perhaps we're all most familiar with, which is getting money and ransoms, prisoners and ransoms from either the government or private sources. And, for example, in 1970, the Tupamaros kidnapped Daniel Mitrione, a U.S. police advisor, and asked for the release of 150 prisoners. When the government wouldn't give in, Mitrione was killed. In Argentina, in the period of the so-called Dirty War from basically about 1970 to about 1979, with different stages, there were some ransoms as large as $60 million paid to terrorists for the release of prisoners. So in other words, there are a variety of rationales for why terrorists take hostages, which is one of the problems, as I'll get into in a moment. Often the U.S. government responds to a terrorist hostage situation thinking, well, they're out for money, and they may not even be terribly concerned about the monetary ransom. They may have other goals. But we often tend to think, well, that the immediate demand is the real demand. And yet often this is not the case. So that's one a very important thing to keep in mind about hostage situations. The immediate demand of either money or hostages or publication of a manifesto may not in any sense be the ultimate demand. Okay, well, let me move on to my second point, which is pattern of governmental responses in general to hostage taking. And broadly speaking, there are sort of four alternatives that you can take in response to a hostage situation. The most hardline approach is, well, next to sending in the commandos, is you won't make any concessions and you won't even negotiate. This is war. If somebody's taken prisoner, not only are we not going to release anybody, but we're not even going to talk to the terrorists about releasing anybody. And this has been the policy of some of the really hardline governments in Latin America. And also, for a while, at least publicly, this was U.S. policy. Now, the policy caused so much debate and concern about among the families of those who were being held hostage that very quickly the U.S. backed away from saying we weren't going to negotiate. And we quickly said, well, we will talk. Former Secretary of State Kissinger put it, we will talk to terrorists, but we will not negotiate with them. Now, only Henry would have known precisely what that fine point. Maybe in German there are two words, talk and negotiate. But at any rate, the Israelis also, for considerable periods in their history, have had a policy that they will not even talk to terrorists about people who are being held hostage. So that's the first policy, no concessions, no negotiations, no contact period. Second policy is essentially that you will negotiate, but at the same time you won't make any substantive concessions. And after the U.S. had straightened itself out from the imbroglio of talk versus negotiations, basically this was U.S. policy, the policy we pursued over, say, the taking of the hostages in Iran by the Ayatollah and the embassy, the hostages in Latin America, that we would talk to the terrorists involved, but we would not make the concessions that they asked for. And until Iran-Contra, which I'll get to in a moment, Iran-Contra marks a break where the U.S. not only negotiates, but actually starts making substantive concessions by selling arms. But that's the second policy where you will negotiate, you will have some, in other words, from the point of view of the government, and the reason why some people are opposed to negotiations of any form, the government is in effect making a concession when they negotiate with terrorists. They're acknowledging to some extent the other side has some legitimacy. And that's a big step, and even if you don't make any concessions, in effect the terrorists have gotten something out of the hostage taking. They brought the government to the bargaining table. Well, thirdly, there's the policy that you will not only negotiate, but you will make concessions. And a number of the European countries have adopted this policy. You know, they just in effect say, whatever it takes to end the crisis, we'll do it. For example, Austria in the case in 1973 when some Palestinians seized a few prisoners in Vienna for the train at the end of the train route for Soviet jewelry from Russia to Vienna, and they agreed to close down the train route from Soviet Union to Vienna for Soviet jewelry. And the Hanafi case in Washington in 1977 where several buildings were seized by the Hanafi Muslims, and to bargain them out of it, it was agreed, some fairly minor concessions were made, but nevertheless concessions, that the leader of the raid was allowed to go home on his own recognizance, and for a while the movie Muhammad, Messenger of God, was stopped playing in New York. You see, this is not the first time there's been a controversy over Islam and sort of mass entertainment. There was the movie Muhammad, Messenger of God, which must have been a dud because it didn't play for very long. But it was very offensive to many Muslims because it showed Muhammad's face. And under Islamic law, you're not supposed to show a facial image of Muhammad. So that's a third policy. You can negotiate and make concessions. And one thing I would point out, everybody makes concessions, at least sometimes. There's always going to be something where what's at stake is very important, and what's being demanded is fairly trivial, so you'll make the concessions. And I meant the Hanafi case, the problem was, we did not at that time have the Delta Force ready. And the only thing we could have done had we had like 100 people down at the B'nai B'rith headquarters being held hostage on the top floor. And the only way to have stormed the building would have been to call in the local police, who were not trained in storming tactics. And it could have been, you know, another Attica or something like that, where just everybody starts shooting, and the next thing you know, several dozen people are dead. And I know the psychiatrist who handled the negotiations, he's a good friend of mine from MIT, and he said the alternative to storming it was they got some of the Islamic ambassadors in Washington to sit down with the Hanafis and go over the Quran in detail about, because these people were all Muslims, and the ambassadors convinced them after a while that the killing of the hostages was a violation of Islamic law. So they figured that and a few minor token concessions was better than storming the building. And I think that was basically a correct policy. And also I'd mention, even the Israelis made concessions. You know, a few years ago, there were like three of their young soldiers were being held by the Palestinians. They'd been taken prisoner during the Lebanon invasion. And to get back these three soldiers, they released nearly 1,500 Palestinians. So, you know, everybody will make concessions if what is being demanded is important enough, and if what is being demanded seems small, and what's at stake seems large. I mean, it's very hard to stick to a no concessions policy. Well, finally, the final option is, of course, force. The Israelis in Entebbe, the U.S. with Mayaguez, Desert One during the Iran hostage crisis. And force is, you know, not always applicable because at times you don't know whether hostages are being held or where they're being held may be inaccessible to a raid. But nevertheless, force is an option and at times has to be considered. You know, the British SAS stormed the Iranian embassy in 1980, and their policy, the British, I talked to some of the officers in the British police and military who were responsible for that incident, and they said they made the decision to storm the embassy after one person was killed and kicked out the front door. And basically their policy was they could not simply stand by idly and let the prisoners be killed one by one, that once it became clear that the terrorists were going to start killing the prisoners, there was no alternative to the use of force. And I think it's important to recognize in dealing with these hostage situations that one always has to have the military option. It's essential. You may not want to use it all the time. I don't think it would have been wise to do it in the case of the Hanafis, as I said, but you always have to have that option because there are going to be times when the alternative to having the option is just standing by and letting a massacre take place. Well, let me move on to my third point, which is really the focus of the Miller Center, which is, of course, the presidency and hostage taking. And the fact is, the presidency and the management of hostage crises, whether the presidency has been involved in hostage crises ever since the founder of UVA, Thomas Jefferson, sent the fleet after the Barbary Pirates, or in 1904, during the famous incident of where Rasuli, a Moroccan sort of brigand kidnapped someone who was supposedly an American citizen, Perdicaris, who actually turned out to be a Greek citizen. We didn't find that out until 30 years later. But Teddy Roosevelt sent a message to the Republican convention. You know, Roosevelt always had a flair for the dramatic, and said, this government wants Perdicaris alive or Rasuli dead. And they made a movie about this a few years ago to spice it up. Instead of Perdicaris being a man, he was played, I think, by who played Perdicaris? Beautiful young woman, actress. She was in The Sand Pebbles, whoever that was. Wasn't Elizabeth Taylor. And they had Rasuli, was played by Sean Connery. It wasn't much of a movie, apparently, but they spiced up the story a little bit and had Theodore Roosevelt sending the Marines. Roosevelt did send the fleet to Morocco, but with the Marine battalion prepared to charge ashore and rescue Perdicaris. So the president has been involved in hostage-taking for quite some time. What we find, though, in the more recent cases is there are three problems that emerge when the president tries to manage a hostage crisis. The first is what I call emotional over-involvement with the families and the hostages themselves. The president starts meeting with the families of the hostages. Obviously, I've met with many people who've been either hostages or currently hostages, or currently families of hostages. Obviously, they're very distraught. They want everything done for their loved ones. And the president starts meeting with the families. He starts worrying about the hostages, and he gets emotionally over-involved, which leads to certain unfortunate consequences. One is impatience. Something's got to be done. And that was clearly a factor with Carter and Iran. For a variety of reasons, Carter had set in motion certain forces that made it imperative, he felt, to get the hostages out as soon as possible. Partly because, I'll talk about the political reasons in a minute, there's also the personal reason. Carter appears, from everything we can tell, to have been very sincerely concerned about the hostages, very worried about what was happening to them and their families, and he began insisting something's got to be done. And that may have been part of the reason for the, I think, ill-advised attempt at the rescue mission. Not only does it lead to impatience, but perhaps even more, it can lead to some very unwise decisions because of the emotional over-involvement. And that, I think, is the real story of Reagan and Iran-Contra. Now, we probably won't know the full story until everybody gets all their kiss-and-tell memoirs done. But there is a lot of evidence to suggest the primary thing motivating Reagan, not maybe everybody else, but the primary thing motivating the president was he was very concerned about the Lebanese hostages. He had been meeting regularly with the families. They had been calling him. He had been calling them. And he was determined that something had to be done. Now, we're right in the middle of the trial of Oliver North, so we may find out exactly what the president did or did not order Oliver North to do, and whether it was simply a Henry II case where one day he blows up and says, why can't you guys get these hostages out of Lebanon? And in the case of Henry II, of course, they go off and kill the Archbishop of Canterbury. But, Thomas Becket, in the case of Reagan, some of his aides may have decided, well, the president's really upset about this, we better do something, in a hurry. But certainly the decision to sell arms to Iran was very unwise and led to a whole series of very negative consequences, which we will probably be exploring the ramifications of and feeling the ramifications for quite some time. But I think it was largely because of the emotional over-involvement of the president in the pain and hurt of the families of the hostages in Lebanon. So that's the first problem, emotional over-involvement on the part of the president. Secondly, there is an attempt at over-management of rescue operations. By that I mean that the president in a rescue operation, you know, from having talked at length to the Israelis about rescue operations and some of their people, including several of the officers who were on the Entebbe raid, is that at a certain point you have to, in effect, just cross your fingers and say, okay, guys, do your stuff. You cannot have the president managing the crisis all the way through the rescue operation. In other words, at a certain point you have to let go and just hope for the best. Well, what has happened in some of the American rescue operations has been an attempt by the president to keep his finger right in the pie of the rescue operation, all the way through the rescue operation. And in fact, to not let the rescue force improvise or do what they feel is necessary on the spot. For example, in the Mayaguez, I was told by one of the soldiers who was there that the commander of the Marine Battalion Force attacking Kontoon Island had the president on the other end of his radio. You know, the president should not be trying to fine-tune an assault thousands of miles away. That's up to the Marine officer involved. And similarly with Desert One, Carter wanted to be in the position and insisted that he be allowed to call back the operation at any point and to say what they could and could not do at any point. And that, bad as Desert One was, and we had 8 of our soldiers killed and the debacle in the desert, it could have been much worse if we'd actually gotten into downtown Tehran and then the president starts trying to fine-tune the operation. Because the whole rescue force could have been cut. So imagine something like suddenly the Iranian population hears that the Americans are in Tehran. They would have gone crazy. And the president at that point, you know, in a situation like that, you cannot let the president thousands of miles away try to fine-tune the rescue operation. But that is a real problem with the presidency and the management of these hostage crises, is the president tries to have too much control. Now, that's understandable because the president feels he's the commander-in-chief, he should control, but the fact is, for a rescue operation to be successful, you have to let the forces on the ground have some initiative. You know, in Tebbi, what the Israelis did is, once the plane took off, they maintained radio silence. And it wasn't until the plane landed in Kenya that the people back home knew that the hostages were safe. And they just trusted their own officers. And in a situation like that, that's what you have to do. You have to trust your own people on the ground. Well, a third problem with the management of presidency and hostage crises is electoral pressures. Now, we of course have 4-year presidential cycles, and the terrorists know our presidential system as well as anybody, and they know when the New Hampshire primary is, and they know all this stuff. So they're quite capable of fine-tuning their operations to interfere with our electoral cycle. And the hostage situation a number of years ago was, of course, LBJ and the Pueblo, which took place January 1968, right as the election season is beginning. Remember the good old days when the election season began in January 1968 of the presidential year rather than 4 years before. But this was 68, and this was before we started. Remember how it used to be that when you were running for president, it was considered bad taste to announce your candidacy before January of the election year? You were always supposed to go around saying very coyly that you are not a candidate. Well, this has all changed, and people announce 2 and 3 years in advance now. But LBJ was running for president, the Pueblo happens, and he's under enormous pressure domestically to do something about the Pueblo. Now, fortunately in this case, Johnson steps down from the race in March 31st, 1968. So in effect, he's able to manage the Pueblo incident without electoral pressures. It's interesting to speculate what would have happened if he'd gone on running. I think the Pueblo would have been a much bigger issue in the campaign. As it was, we had Richard Nixon in the famous phrase that when a fourth-rate military power seizes an American ship on the high seas, it's time for new leadership.
And then 3 months after he was president, the North Korean shot down one of our reconnaissance planes, and nothing happened. As someone said, when I was a child, I spoke as a child, but now I became a man, and I speak as a man. So that was the end of fourth-rate military powers pushing us around.
Well, Carter and Iran was perhaps the classic case of what happens when a presidential crisis, when a hostage crisis takes place during a presidential campaign year. And I think we can learn certain things from it. It can lead to very poor and unwise policies. In Carter's case, when the Iran hostage crisis first broke, and I don't say this to deny the sincerity of his concern, but all politicians have at least some selfish self-survival instincts. They wouldn't be at the top of the poll if they didn't have them. And early on, I think Carter realized that he was in a tight race with Senator Kennedy. And early on, he starts focusing an enormous amount of attention on the Iran hostages. Everything from not lighting the Christmas tree to announcing he won't leave the White House until the hostages are freed. And of course, what happens is that this begins to backfire after a few months because he's put enormous emphasis on it. He's really got the public. Now, of course, the media, to some extent, was stirring up the public independently of what the president was doing. But Carter, instead of trying to keep the public calm, saying this may take a long time, he sort of revs up the engines of public sentiment himself. Well, all of a sudden, by the spring, he's in a real jam. He said he won't come out of the White House until the hostages are freed, but there's a major political battle going out in the Democratic Party. The election is coming up, and it increasingly looks like the Ayatollah is not going to let those hostages go anytime soon. And at that point, I think he was under enormous pressure to try the Desert One operation. Unfortunately, when people get desperate, they often will try a rescue operation under unwise conditions. And I talked to the Israelis and asked for their assessment of Desert One, and they said it should never have been tried. It was too complicated. It just had no chance of success. I also talked to one of the commandos on the raid, and he gave me a full briefing of what they were supposed to do, and it was infinitely more complicated than Entebbe and had a very low chance of success. Then, having had the botched rescue attack, Carter makes a second mistake, or a second problem. He now has to decide what he's going to do about the campaign, and he in effect says, I'll leave the White House and start campaigning. Well, his credibility is shot at that point. He said he would never leave the White House as long as the hostages were being held, and then he leaves the White House to start campaigning. And suffice to say, this whole election year cycle really disrupted any attempt to develop a stable long-term policy towards the Iran hostage crisis. Well, by way of conclusion, let me just propose some possible solutions to these presidential problems, hostage crises. And let me just say that I fully recognize that solutions are not easy because these are very deeply rooted structural problems. First, it's been suggested, that the president actually not even meet with the families of hostages because this leads to excessive emotional involvement. Now, I think this is frankly impossible. If a significant number of people are being held hostage, the president's going to have to meet with their families. Otherwise, he will risk looking callous and unconcerned. The families will get upset. They will go to the media. Michael Dukakis in the campaign paid a very heavy price for not meeting with the family of the woman who was assaulted by the man he released from prison. People said he was callous and unconcerned. I think the president has to meet with the families of hostage victims. On the other hand, I think, it's something that as a teacher I've learned is one has at the same time, one should not start as president soaking up the pain of the hostage victims. You know, as a teacher or as a therapist or as a young doctor or a young clergyman, one of the first things you have to learn is you don't go out and start
living the pain and experiences of the people you're dealing with, because it will destroy you psychologically. It will cloud your judgment. You don't have to live the pain of the people you're trying to help. And I think that's an important thing. The president has to learn that, frankly, you know, there, in many cases in these hostage situations, there is just not a lot that can be done right away, and he will just have to be patient. And it's, I will be the first to admit this is much easier said than done, because when you have desperate people asking you to do something, it's not easy to say nothing can be done. But I think a certain degree of emotional attachment is going to have to be essential in these cases. Secondly, as far as the management of rescue missions, I think the president is going to have to accept the fact that rescue missions cannot be too tightly controlled. That's a hard thing in American politics, where the president is, you know, such a central figure. He's the commander-in-chief as well as being head of state. But the fact is, you know, rescue missions, if we're going to undertake them, and as I said, you always have to have the rescue mission as a possible option, there's going to have to be the development of trust between the president and his rescue commanders, to the extent where the president will let them do what they think is necessary. You can't have the president on the radio during the storming of the building. And I would therefore say that, you know, that's just, here again, that's a lot easier said than done, because understandably the president feels that if anything goes terribly wrong in the rescue mission, he will be bearing the political consequences, not the rescue commander. So there's an understandable desire to control the political manifestations of a rescue mission. However, at a certain point, and I think this is just one of the hard facts of rescue missions, you'd better not try them at all if you're going to try to control every last detail. If you don't, there's no such thing as a risk-free rescue operation. I remember talking to one of the Israeli soldiers who stormed the built, you may all remember the Maalot incident in 1974, when 100 Israeli school children were being held by Palestinian terrorists. And I remember talking to one of the soldiers who stormed the building, and he said that it was bad enough they lost 20 children in the assault, but what was even worse, it could have been much worse, because he pointed out that an Israeli soldier kicked in the door to the building and shot a Palestinian terrorist just as the guy was reaching up to pull a lever to a bomb that would have detonated the entire building. So they could have lost all 100 children. And boy, would there have been a political price to pay for that in Israel. But the fact is, you can't guarantee that a rescue operation won't be a disaster. They're not all as slick and neat as in Tebbe. In real life, things are a little more complicated than they are in Mission Impossible. And finally, and this is a more I put in the category of advice, but I think Carter's experiences will teach other presidents the dangers thereof. Hostage situations and electoral politics have to be kept separate. It's not safe, not good for the president, and it's not good for the country. And I think Carter learned that the hard way, that actually my friend in the State Department, who had managed the Hanafi Muslim case, resigned in protest over Carter's handling of the Iran-Contra case, Iran hostage case. He didn't make a big stink about it, he just quietly resigned. Because he said, Carter is totally mismanaging this thing. He has joined the electoral goals of his presidency with this hostage crisis, and it's going to be a disaster. And so I think future presidents would do well to learn from the experience of Carter, which is that however tempting the short-run gains of being of what Elizabeth Drew called commander-in-chief politics, in the long run, it's poison for the presidency, for a president to wrap his presidency around a hostage crisis. And so I think, therefore, what the president needs to do in a hostage crisis is keep it separate from his electoral goals. Well, thank you very much. I'll be happy to take your questions now.
One very quick one. Have you And then I'd like to comment on your on your comments. Have you read a book, small one, not well known, called Military Incompetency by a guy by the name of Gilbert?
I have seen the book. If it's a book, I think of it's the subtitle or something.
Why America Never Wins Wars.
Yes. Okay.
It follows up on what you say, shows the incompetency in all these rescue operations, seven of them. Let me leave that. In your responses, the choice of responses, you did not, as I understood it, include retaliation, unless you included that in your, what you said, force. But I think that's a little different. You have rescue operations which require military force. Then you have retaliations of very, it can be military or economic or something else. The Israelis do that. Somebody bombs them, they wait 3 days and then they demolish a town or something.
Right.
And I don't know if that's correct, but I think that's another choice you have, is retaliation at your choice.
Yeah, certainly you do. In the case of any terrorist incident, you know, you have the option of retaliation, and the Israelis have sort of developed reprisal into a fine art, you know, that you can almost tell exactly what's going to happen. If three Israelis are killed, X number of Palestinian homes will be bombed. Retaliation is a very emotional topic right now because, you know, for example, what if we had, as we used to say with Watergate, smoking gun evidence about who blew up that Pan Am jet? And what would we do? Let's say we had smoking gun evidence that it was Libya backing some radical Palestinians. Should we then go attack Libya? And I guess the thing is to remember about retaliation is that in certain respects, it's a game that the Western powers can't win, because we're dealing with people, in dealing with terrorists, often they don't care about if some of their people are killed, whereas we care passionately if some of our people are killed. I guess what I feel about retaliation is that except in extreme cases, you should avoid it. And if you are going to retaliate, do it the way the Israelis do in another sense, which is, I remember in 1979, I was talking to one of my Israeli friends, and he was looking very smug and happy that day. And I said, okay, what are you looking so happy about? And he said, well, do you remember that car bomb in Beirut a couple days ago? And I said, yes, I read about it. He said, well, we've just closed the book on the Munich operation. We have now assassinated every PLO leader who had anything to do with the Munich operation. Well, that sort of retaliation has some effect, I think. You know, if you really think that if you do something like the Munich operation, that your life is on the line, I think that has some deterrent effect. Whereas I think historically it's been demonstrated over and over again that the Israeli policy of bombing Lebanon every time the PLO attacks has no effect at all. If you can actually target individual people who are responsible for terrorist incidents, like if we could find the three terrorists or four terrorists or whoever it was who blew up the Pan Am jet, and if they knew that for the rest of their lives they couldn't sleep two nights in the same bed, that might have a deterrent effect. On the other hand, if we found out that it was Libya was the ones who gave the plastic explosives to them, I don't think bombing Libya would have an effect.
Next question. Yes,
Professor Kern.
In connection with decoupling the electoral process from the hostage situation, there are two parties to the electoral process, and the incumbent. Now, Carter made some mistakes as an incumbent, perhaps, but unless you deal with the opponent's side, there's some agreement that the opponents would not use the hostage situation as an electoral issue, then I don't see how you could, you know, a sitting president would agree. You see what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
So there has to be some mechanism there to get some sort of agreement between the parties not to use this issue.
I think
not
you're,
just what a president may or may not do.
I think you're right, and I think, in fact, Carter, remember this was like 79, 80, Carter was haunted, I think, to a considerable extent by the memory of Pueblo and the fact that Nixon had rather unscrupulously used the incident of Pueblo, you know, for a lot of, you know, it was a cheap rhetorical shot, and Nixon, as he showed when he became president and they shot down the plane and killed 30 people, he had no intention, he would not have acted on the Pueblo any different than Johnson did, in all probability. But, so you're right, I mean, if you're going to decouple the process of hostages from the electoral process, you have to have some agreement between the parties as to leaving this stuff out of presidential politics. And as someone who's worked in campaigns all his life, I know it's in the heat of campaigns, it's not easy to do that. You'll grab any issue that will look effective. I guess what I would say is that I would say that when the crisis first began over the hostages in Iran, Carter had the potential to decouple, because at that point there was enough sense of national unity that he could have put the issue a little on the back burner, got agreements with both his party rivals and his Republican of opposition to leave this issue off the agenda of the campaign. I think where it became impossible to decouple was when there was a growing perception that, in effect, Carter was running as commander-in-chief, you know, as Elizabeth Drew said. And at that point, you know, everybody started ganging up on him on the hostage issue. But you're right, it's not an easy issue, and I guess what I would say is that, you know, people have proposed that, you know, terrorism is in effect a state of war, and we have to start gearing up in effect for a state of war now. What I would say is it in many ways terrorism is a war, but it's a very different type. It's not a World War II type war, so we're not going to get the sort of national unity or anything that we got in World War II to the extent we had that unity, which, as we all know from studying the presidency, there was not the unity it seemed at the time. But I guess what I'd just say is that I hope future presidents will learn something from Carter's experience, which is, in the long run, decoupling is best for everybody. Best for him, best for the opposition, best for the primary opponents. And coupling, trying to run as commander-in-chief, you know, in the short run, he had spectacular results. Carter's popularity increased 30%.
And say that this is a basic principle of international relations which has never been, has been held inviolate by some pretty barbarous regimes before, and demanded of the Security Council, after all the diplomatic consultations that go before this, that Iran be expelled from the United Nations activity until or unless the hostages were released, and if we had trouble with pressuring, withdrawn from any participation in the United Nations until the hostages were increased. My guess is we could have gotten a Security Council vote, including those of the Soviet Union and China, if we'd had the guts to press it and make the stakes big. This is not an option that is open to you in most other types of hostage crises, but I would suggest that I think that's where Carter made his mistake, because what the Iranians wanted out of the hostage crisis was a status, the ability to defy the United States, States and get away with it in order to muster their domestic supporters. If the consequence was international isolation, they would have failed badly in that purpose, and the pressure to release the hostages would have been very considerable.
Well, first of all, I agree that I think Carter, in managing the crisis, could have done a lot more to use the United Nations and other international organizations. But you're right, I mean, even in World War II, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, you know, the diplomatic communities of the U.S. and Germany and Japan were returned and we returned their diplomats. I mean, that's just a very ancient principle of diplomacy, that diplomats are to be not attacked by the states to which they are being represented. And I think a lot could have been, I think you're right, in the early stages of the crisis, there was, from what I was in Washington at the time, and just, you know, and what I heard was that even a number of the Islamic countries were prepared to go along with various drastic sanctions against
them. If we'd acted quickly and promptly, I called up people in the department, because I used to work in the department, and asked them why they weren't going to take this to the UN immediately and with some force. You know, we took it to the UN and wanted condemnation and all that business, stuff on paper, but didn't have any action in it. And we were just too timid. We were afraid of what it might do to the hostages themselves. There wasn't any question about that. Was why we were namby-pamby about what we did.
There was a fact, I think, very quick, what causes international support to begin to fall away is that Carter, I think, is perceived early on as, this is getting wrapped up in Carter's political campaign.
But this is far enough back that aspect would have been pretty thin if he'd done it immediately.
If just in response to the earlier gentleman's question, if Carter had decoupled early on from his campaign this incident and gone the route you suggested, I would fully agree that would have been a lot more successful than what he was trying to do, which was alternatively carrots and sticks, which really made no coherent sense of policy. First he would try to apply moral pressure, then he would try to apply sanctions, then he'd try a rescue operation, and there was no consistent policy. And the only consistent thread you can find in it is Carter is embroiled in a very tough electoral campaign, and it seems to be that everything that he's doing is related to that campaign.
And heightening public attention, too.
And heightening public attention. And I would say this, I think, looking back on it, I fully agree, I think we had the moral high ground. The first month of the crisis, we could have gotten massive international support for the principle of protection of diplomatic facilities.
And we ended up semi-isolated.
We ended up with one of our typical UN coalitions where it's us, Luxembourg, and Belgium against the rest of the UN. It was a badly managed. From the point of view of considering what was at stake, which was the principle that diplomats not be attacked by the countries to which they're represented, it's amazing how little support we ended up a year from the crisis.
If Carter had not had the reputation of being timid and ineffectual, would he then have felt less compelled to demonstrate strength on this issue, do you think?
I think that's a good point. He had the problem that the hostage crisis strikes, if some of you may remember, the summer of 79, Carter is in many ways has gotten to a dangerous stage in the presidency. He's being laughed at. Remember the killer rabbit? He's in his canoe and he says a killer rabbit attacks him. Well, the media makes that a great big story. And he gives his speech on Syn fuels and then has his departmental report cards. Every department head is to fill out a report card on him and his staff. He shakes up his cabinet, he fires. Well, by the end of the summer of 79, Carter has got his popularity is about 28-29% in the polls. He's facing a strong challenge from Senator Kennedy. He's widely perceived as inept, weak, and incompetent. And I think he was unfortunately in the position of having the feeling he had to demonstrate strength over the Iran crisis. And as the policy you outlined, sir, would have been, I think, a very effective demonstration of strength. Carter felt he had to, instead, the way he tried to show strength was by running as commander-in-chief and making this a great emotional American issue rather than de-emphasizing that aspect and drawing in the international community.
Dr. Evans has interviewed terrorists in Northern Ireland and Lebanon and the Middle East. We're all fascinated with the Carter case, but there are questions on other cases.
You mentioned the Argentine situation. What was done there may have been, and we look at it, reprehensible, but it certainly worked.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's put it this way. What happened in Argentina, just for those who are not familiar with the politics, is in 76, the military took power and overthrew Isabel Perón. Now, at that time, one thing to remember, Argentina was in a state of civil war. The Montoneros and the ERP, the two main urban guerrilla groups, were so strong that they could stage battalion-sized attacks in downtown Buenos Aires. I mean, these were big groups. They weren't little groups of little cells of three and four people. These were large, well-organized urban terrorist armies. And the Argentinian military came in and basically said, it's our heads or theirs. And instituted what they called the Dirty War. And in the course of the Dirty War, several thousands of people were killed. Now, what I would say, and I think this is something as Americans we should always remember, Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. There are times when violence gets so out of control that you have to abridge civil liberties. And that's a painful thing to do, but even our own Constitution gives the President the right to suspend the writ of habeas corpus in times of rebellion or insurrection. And we have the Ku Klux Klan Act on the books, which gives the President sweeping powers to use the military to restore order. Now, I would hope in our own country we never get to a situation where we have to have bayonets in the street again the way we did back in the 60s, but it could come. You know, we certainly, you know, the sort of violence that terrorists engage in, and, you know, one of the things that struck me talking to, like, particularly some of the young IRA recruits, is they're willing to push things quite far. You know, you try to talk to them about, you know, I knew perfectly well it's futile to argue with these people. I was just trying to get their points of view. But you talk to some of the young IRA guys, and their attitude is, well, maybe it will be a bloodbath to liberate Ireland, but we're willing to pay that price. And when you have that mentality that you're willing to kill 20, 30,000 people to get what you want, a government has to be prepared to take very tough measures.
Next question. Yes, Howard Thurman.
I've often wondered if my perception is right. The Russians are not nearly as often the targets of terrorism as America and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
What are the factors, if that's true, what are the factors that keeps Russia from being attacked by terrorism?
Well, basically, I think the most fundamental reason, and one thing to remember, the Soviet Union, now that they have started a liberalization program and opened things up, one consequence may be that they're going to start having some domestic extremists and violence of their own. But I think the basic reason is that in the current era, most revolutionary movements tend to be from the left. Now, this does not mean they are sympathetic to the Soviet Union. Many of them are Maoist, as Sendero Luminoso is in Peru, or Trotskyist, as some of the groups in El Salvador are. And they're not in any sense, they regard the Soviet Union as having betrayed socialism. But it's one of those things that they regard their primary opponent as the United States. Ideologically, they regard the United States as a more important and more dangerous adversary than the Soviet Union. And consequently, they tend to focus on the United States. I mean, something like one-third of the acts of international terrorism are directed against Americans, either diplomats or civilians overseas. And the number against Soviets is trivial. There's an occasional act of Jewish Defense League terrorism against Russian diplomats, occasionally Armenian terrorism against Russian diplomats. Every now and then there will be hijacking from an East European country, to usually by people who just want to get out of the country, not so much by terrorists. But your perception is correct. There's not much terrorism against the Soviet bloc, and I think the major reason is there are terrorists of the extreme right. In this country, we have, for example, our dear friend David Duke just got elected to the Louisiana legislature and is now trying to be Mr. Respectability, but I've been following David for about 10 years, and he's not respectable, I assure you of that. Everything but it. I remember seeing a picture of David in a Nazi stormtrooper uniform carrying a sign saying, "Gas the Chicago 7." So he's everything but respectable. He's too photogenic and articulate for his own good, unfortunately. But he's been called by the New York Times the man in the gray flannel light sheet.
I have a comment and a question related thereto. I wonder if there isn't a further motive for terrorism, namely the weakness of the terrorist group itself. They demand within the group to do something, to show some result. And a terrorist act is an easy way of appearing to be effective and do something to get publicity. But the pressure may be, in fact, a factor of weakness. Indeed, there are those who allege that the current difficulties in Iran over the book is a struggle for power and a weakness factor in the Iranian situation itself. And incidentally, those terrorists certainly are not left-wing.
Certainly.
The question I have really is this. Do we know enough in your field now, not only to distinguish between various motives, but to begin to match various methods of dealing with terrorism to the causes of terrorism? Can we get any rough match in some cases, or are we ad hocing it all the time, and in which case all the initiative rests with the terrorists, not with the response?
Well, I think, first of all, your point about terroristic violence, and terrorism has been historically called the weapon of the weak. Groups that are out of power, marginal, groups that can achieve their goals through other means, the military can coup, labor unions can strike.
And it's nothing new, it goes back centuries.
No, I mean, a friend of mine at the CIA put together a chronology of terrorist events, and he said the first recorded kidnapping was when Joseph was sold by his brothers in Egypt. and his list of kidnappings went on from there. And so there's nothing new about terrorism in that sense. It tends to be, I think terrorism historically has been a weapon of movements that had no other easily available resource, because it greatly magnified their impact. You know, if you look at the Symbionese Liberation Army, the group that kidnapped Patty Hearst, you know, it was a small group, maybe 10, 12 people, and yet they dominated, they got extensive media coverage for nearly a year for a really minor set of activities. They killed one person, kidnapped Patty Hearst, robbed a few banks, and you know, the sort of stuff that wouldn't even make page one in the Washington Post anymore, if it was ordinary crime. You know, but, you know, if it's ordinary crime, you've got to get at least 10 people in Washington to get on page one these days. But, you know, that's how bad crime is in D.C. People are very lucky out here, I guess. But terrorism, you know, is a small act of violence, if it's political, can get enormous attention and have profound ramifications. I think as far as the causes of terrorism and how does it relate to broader political issues, I think there's a lot of work to be done there. And I think particularly in the area of why some movements resort to violence and others don't, why some systems have a lot of, why does
So one country in Latin America have a great deal of violence, and another country have relatively little. There are lots of suggestive indicators, but I don't think anyone's developed much more comprehensive overall themes. So I would say that your point's well taken.
As we did a couple of days ago, Bill Wemple, the last question.
Do you think it would be helpful, even assuming it were possible, if all the media would agree that they would not publish anything about a hostage crisis except what the White House designated office puts out, and they would not interview any of the terrorists, the IRA people?
I would say something, well, first of all, there are cases where clearly the media went well beyond any reasonable standard of coverage. I remember being in Washington during the Hanafi Muslim thing, and the media were just like bulldogs. I mean, they were calling up Khalis, the leader of the Hanafi Muslims, and trying to get interviews with him while he's still in the B'nai B'rith Book. And at one point, some reporter referred to Mr. Khalis as a black Muslim. Well, he's not a black Muslim, he's a Hanafi Muslim. And one thing you learn about terrorists when you interview them is they're very sensitive about these distinctions, especially since Khalis, two of his children and his wife had been murdered by the black Muslims. So he's kind of sensitive about being called a black Muslim. And he went wild and said he was going to execute some of the hostages unless he got an immediate apology. So the reporter had to call him up again and apologize. And they had reporters crawling all over the downtown area where the buildings were, trying to get interviews with everybody to put on the evening news. And this was clearly well beyond, I think everybody in the Washington Press Corps, when it was all over, agreed that this had gotten completely out of hand. And I would say that in dealing with hostage situations, certainly when in something like the Hanafi case, there's got to be a great deal of journalistic restraint. Now, I'm realistic enough to know that as long as the media is a competitive business of scoops, of investigative journalism, it's going to be very hard to get restraint. If CBS has something that ABC doesn't have, it's not going to be good for somebody at ABC. But there has to be a great deal of media restraint, whether government mandated or privately agreed on these hostage situations, because otherwise they become surfaces, as they did in the Hanafi case, and it becomes dangerous to the lives of the hostages. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that, talking to the chief negotiator during the Hanafi case, that one of the biggest problems he had was they had reporters down interviewing the police, asking when the assault was going to take place. And of course, the Hanafis are watching all this on television, so they know what's going on. And this was just completely irresponsible in the highest degree.
Also, one of the reasons for some hostage taking.
Oh, very definitely. That.
Just to get that circus.
That circus, there's no doubt, and as a gentleman mentioned, and I forgot to respond to, there's no doubt in my mind that our beloved friend the Ayatollah seized on this book as a means of making sure in his own mind that his successors in Iran are every bit as fundamentalist as he is, because it's the old story. Just in the past few months there has been quiet talk that the next generation in Iran were going to patch up relations with the U.S. But that's one thing the legacy the Ayatollah does not want to leave. And it's true that he's 88, but in that part of the world, remember, they eat all that yogurt and they live to be 100 and everything. And so we may have the Ayatollah with us for quite some time. But your question is very well taken. A
friend of mine did a content analysis of the programs of the American Political Science Association at the height of the Vietnam War. And he found that for 7 years there had not been a panel on the Vietnam War by the scholars of the American Political Science Association. So our guest has been daring and tackling a very urgent current problem. He probably is a little offbeat in doing it because scholars often shy away from the most important issues, and we're glad he has, and we hope he'll continue, and one of these days we hope he'll write an individual book on the presidency and terrorism. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I got pretty riled up at the time. I can imagine why. Very good people. Very good
people. One of your greatest supporters.
All right. David Arias.
Chairman of the library.
This is Jack Archie, European
I got all the I'm Gary White.